This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done things, who have endured things that are really hard to imagine, and that is certainly the case today with Niall Smith. The point of this program is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we are educated, we're entertained, and we're certainly inspired by these stories from members of our greatest generation. Our guest today, 91-year-old Niall Smith of Fresno, California, originally from the Decatur, Illinois area. He's a recipient of the Purple Heart, the Bronze Star, and the Soldier's Medal. Very interesting story behind the events that led to a couple of those medals, and we're going to get to that. But let's start a little earlier on, Niall. Growing up in rural Illinois, you said Decatur was the closest town. That tells me that you were out in the country somewhere?
Yeah, it was a small town called La Place, Illinois. And I was raised on a farm. Me and my dad were a farmer.
What'd you guys grow?
Corn, soybeans, wheat, clover for cows and everything.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Six brothers, no sisters.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a lot of hands on the farm then.
Yeah. Of course, they're not all at the same time, but there's over three or four boys there to help do the farming and the work.
So as you're going through high school and all that, were you dreaming of getting off the farm at some point and going somewhere else?
Well, yeah. I was going to go to college. I graduated from high school in 1940, and I had a scholarship to a college in Carthage, Illinois. But then the war came along, so that was that.
Yeah, you had just celebrated your 19th birthday about a month before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember where you were when you found out about that?
Yes. You never forget a thing like that. Well, we were in a lay place there in the farmhouse in a dining room. It was about, or when we heard about it, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was sitting there listening to the radio. My dad was over in the corner in the rocking chair asleep, and the announcement came on. The Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor. All military personnel, if you're on leave or wherever you are, get back to your bases immediately. So I woke my dad up and told him, what? He couldn't believe it, see?
Did that hit you like a ton of bricks? Was that a pretty big deal?
Well, it's hard to believe. Mm-hmm. It was hard to believe, you know. So then I went into service in January of 42.
So you weren't waiting around to get drafted. You said, I want to do something?
Well, I didn't want to be in the Army, really, because, you know, they had a lot of time on the ground and everything. So either the Air Force or the Navy. So I enlisted in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. How many of your brothers ended up serving in the war?
Okay, two others during the war. Altogether, there were five of us brothers that had been in the service.
Wow.
Four of us had retired from the service.
How many years were you in?
22 years, 2 months and 6 days.
Not too many veterans I get to interview who served in both World War II and the Vietnam War, but that's the case for Niall. We're going to hear about that. And you mentioned the other brothers that were in World War II. Did they make it home as well?
Yeah, everybody made it home.
You had quite the odds to beat to make it home yourself. We're going to get to that. But let's talk about those early days in the Army Air Corps. Did you go in hoping that you could become a pilot? Because most guys that did something in the Army Air Corps say they wanted to be pilots.
Yeah, I wanted to be a pilot, but you got to, at that time, you got to have education.
Mm-hmm.
I think now it's 4 years, but at that time it was 2 years. So I knew I couldn't be a pilot, so I said, well, I'll be a gunner or something like that, be on an air crew. At the time I applied, that was all filled up, so I couldn't get that. So I ended up being a mechanic. I went to mechanic school.
Mm-hmm. Little did you know what was ahead of you. Little did you know some of the adventures you would have, the close calls you would have. That it wasn't just medals you brought home from the war. You brought home something that's lasted a lot longer and been a lot more important to you. We'll get to that before we're done. But when you say a mechanic in the Army Air Corps, what did that mean you were responsible for, and how much responsibility did you feel?
Well, you went to aircraft mechanic school on a B-17. Of course, we didn't know what kind of planes we were going to be or working on or assigned to. Then, we found out it was going to be B-17s. There was about five men on a ground crew. There's always a crew chief, assistant crew chief, and then two or three other guys. You start out just ground crew, but I ended up being assistant crew chief. Of course, that takes several years to get up to that. But it's B-17s.
Mm-hmm.
And our group was formed, the 96 Bomb Group was formed in Walla Walla, Washington. And our commander at that time was Archie J. Olds. He was a colonel. He was later on, after the war and everything, he was in charge of 15th Air Force at March Air Force Base. He was a general, some kind of general.
And from going on the farm with your brothers to at these different bases with all these guys from all over the country, was that a bit of an eye-opener for you?
Oh, yeah. Started out in Walla Walla, Washington, was there a month. Rapid City, South Dakota for a month. Pocatello, Idaho for 2 months, I think. And then we got on a train and we went clear down around through California and everything to Paoli, Texas. And that base was built, just finished building it. And we were there about 3.5 months and they were continuing training to go overseas. We didn't know where we'd go, but ended up being England.
And I want to talk to you about getting over to England and about what you brought back from England. But the B-17, to be responsible for it operating the way it needs to, I mean, you've got men's lives in your hands every time that plane goes up, don't
you? That's right. Been some nights we worked all night to make sure it's right or, you know, get something done so that they could have the plane for the next day.
Was there part of that? When you go through all your checks and make sure this is operating right and this is moving right and that's running right, was there one part of that that gave you the most trouble or that was the hardest to make sure it was doing what it was supposed to do?
Well, probably the hardest thing was getting there, like when you changed an engine and then you've got to put all the accessories like carburetor and fuel pump and everything else on the new engine, transfer that over and then hang the thing. And getting it adjusted to the right RPM and, make sure that everything is working like it's supposed to work.
Because if it's not, that could cost some people their lives.
Well, that's right. That engine could quit or go out.
So was that fulfilling work for you?
Well, it was at the time, you know. I mean, sure. Just made sure you did the job right. I remember during the war, like in England, lots of nights we were working nighttime. We didn't have big floodlights and everything else. There's a war going on. We use flashlights. You hear a plane overhead, you turn the light out. Because they said that a plane from 10,000 feet can see a cigarette on the ground.
Wow. Yeah, sounds pretty tense.
Yeah, lots of night.
What about the journey over to England? Was that an adventure for you?
Oh, yeah. We got on the train at Paoli up through Fort Worth and Dallas. And at that time, the space between Dallas and Fort Worth, there might have been 20 miles or so. No people. But now it's all one big city. Anyway, then we went up to New York, and we left from Pier 50 on the Queen Elizabeth, the first Queen Elizabeth. And right beside where the Queen Elizabeth was, here was the Normandy lying on its side. Somebody had sabotaged it and it burned.
That's encouraging.
So, yeah. So then we got on the ship and it took us 6 days to go across. They changed course every 7 minutes, zigzag. And mm-hmm. The only people that knew the course was the captain and the navigator. They did that because of the subs. 15,000, 18,000 troops on that one ship, 24 hours in the stateroom, 24 hours on deck. A stateroom that would normally have maybe two or three or four people, here's maybe 18 people assigned to that one room, about four high, you know.
Do you remember what it felt like emotionally? I mean, were you concerned that you might not see America again?
Well, not really. Young people... they're full of energy and they don't think about things like that. They just want to get in the middle of everything and they don't think about dying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't think about it until it actually happens or, you know, something happens and you think you might.
And before you went over there, did you think that your job was going to be a pretty safe job, comparatively speaking?
Well, yeah, but England was getting bombed too, see?
Mm-hmm.
And the first night we were in England, our base got bombed.
Wow. Welcome to the war.
And we didn't have any shelters or anything else. when anything's set up as a new base. See, here was guys diving through hedges to be in a ditch, get in a ditch, stuff like that.
Where'd you go?
I just found a low spot and got in it. But there wasn't anybody killed or anything.
But it got your attention.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how old were you?
Well, I'd be 20, I guess, 19 or 20. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So then your bombers start flying their missions. And tell us what your duty was like those first few weeks and months that you were over there.
Well, we had to get them ready. If they came back, either bomb damage or engine out, something like that, we'd change an engine overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And that would take maybe 6-8 hours. And we heard that the Germans could change an engine in 15 minutes. They had all quick disconnects and everything else. Mm. We didn't. We had hoses and clamps and, you know, all kind of stuff. Anyway, you just keep them ready. And they always called, or they said they need so many planes. We got to have so many planes. So there's lots of times we worked all night, you know, to get one ready. Even changing outer wing panels and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. How did the pilots and the crews of those bombers treat you?
They treated us good, and they depended on us, too. Like the original pilots that we took over there, I mean, they knew what was going on, and they knew that, or they depended on us, and they got to know the ground crew and all that, because you can't have a plane, something happening on the flight. So, yeah, they appreciated it.
And you mentioned having to fix damaged engines or patch up damaged planes. Was that a pretty frequent occurrence? I mean, was it rare for a group of bombers to come back unscathed?
It was rare for them to, very rare for them to come back unscathed until about, it had to be in 44 before the P-51s got over there to where they could go all the way on the mission.
With as escort, yeah?
Right, as escort. Up to that time, they could only go halfway, like a P-47, they'd go halfway and they'd have to turn around. Then you're at the mercy, and here's a German fighter sitting out there waiting, see? So when they came back, there was holes. Of course, you had sheet metal men. That was their job. There was holes. There was half a tail shot off, you know, and stuff like that. So there was lots of damage. And we knew that that's how it would be. It would fly it almost.
Did you ever look at a plane and say, I don't know how that one made it back?
Yeah, yeah. We had one. It wasn't our plane. Let's see. Part of the tail was gone. Two engines were out. A third one was going out. So actually, he only had about one engine, one and a half engine. And he made it back. And when it landed, the gear gave out, and he just slid, you know. I don't know how they made it back. There were six guys wounded.
And you said that wasn't one of your planes, so it makes me wonder, how many planes were you and your crew responsible for?
Well, we were just responsible for the one plane.
The one
plane.
Our plane,
yeah.
So you had the same pilot and crew to deal with for quite a while until they went back to the States?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And the original crews, we got to know pretty well, you know. By the time they rotated or were gone, well, then you get new crews. You remember plane call $5,000?
Uh-huh.
That was on our base. We got that plane.
All right.
One mission. It lasted one mission.
Right. It was called $5,000, of course, because it was the 5,000th B-17 that Boeing had produced since Pearl Harbor. And they had a huge celebration around that plane as it left the plant in the Seattle area. If you were alive back then in May of 1944, maybe you even heard about it in a war bond drive or a newsreel somewhere. And I do have a photo of $5,000 up on our Hometown Heroes Facebook page, so you'll see what I'm talking about. It had 35,000 signatures on it from all the people who had worked on one part or another of that milestone bomber. In fact, they said all those signatures actually added drag to the aircraft and slowed it down in the skies. And as Niall alluded to, $5,000 didn't get off to the best start at the 96th Bomb Group base in Snetterton, England. It had to make a crash landing. But after that, after it was repaired, $5,000 did go on to fly 78 missions with another bomb group. It's a pretty fascinating and multifaceted story about that particular B-17, $5,000. And I do have some links to that story online at hometownheroesradio.com. And you know, Niall Smith's story has some parallels. Before he ever saw all those signatures on $5,000, he had survived a crash a whole lot worse than what that famous plane endured. But what was a mechanic doing up in the air? What brought the plane down in the middle of the night? What did Niall do that earned him the highest honor a soldier can receive for an act of valor in a non-combat situation. And is that really the medal he should have received? We're going to explore some of those questions and more with 91-year-old Niall Smith when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.